please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome not only council, but we have students with us in this session, and they are from Ellsworth High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Cleverly, Caught with Class. And students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are sent materials about the case. They might engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to a court, and after this, the second oral argument, they will meet with the justice assigned that day to meet with the students. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in this case. Counsel are quite welcome to join in that discussion, as well as everyone else who wishes to come. Does anyone want a summary of the case that we're about to hear? It's easier to understand it if you've got a summary of it. If you'd raise your hand, we'll get you a summary. All right? You may be joined by some other students, either from a home school or from another high school. That remains to be seen. I'm going to start on the far left of the bench to introduce it. I'm introducing Justice Gableman, Michael Gableman. He will be the justice with whom you'll meet after this presentation. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice
Crux.
John Roberts.
I know you.
We have a good routine.
Justice Patrick Crux. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case today, which is 09AP1558. John R. Steppens versus Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, and arguing on behalf of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois is Sarah German. I'm sorry, how do you pronounce your name?
German Prey.
German Prey. That's easy now that you've said it.
Yes.
As it's presented. Before you start, Ms. German Prey, as the students must have recognized, there's something different about the Capitol than maybe a month ago. There are many people in the rotunda. Sometimes there are many people, sometimes not. Often we don't have drums or bugles in the rotunda. Often Ian Pizza does not make massive deliveries. They make some deliveries. I've even done some to our chambers, but massive deliveries. And what you've seen is a right of people to petition their government, guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States and the Wisconsin peaceful demonstration of their interests. And you probably walked through other demonstrators to get here. And you probably came in through the King Street entrance in which you were advised to come, because this is an open courtroom and an open courthouse. And therefore, people who wish to come and hear this proceeding may do so. So we appreciate your coming, and your school was given instructions yesterday about how to proceed to enter the building, as were council. Good, because that was the plan. All right. So now you may proceed, Ms. German-Prey.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Attorney Sarah.
Before you begin,
yes.
You are quite tall,
I am.
And it will help us if you raise the podium. There is a button underneath it. Marshall will help you with it so that it fits you better. Just like magic. Thank you very much.
All right. Attorney Sarah German-Prey for subrogated defendant respondent.
You'll have to belt it out, counsel.
Okay. For defendant.
Much better.
Respondent and petitioner, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. A fraud upon the court. That is what the trial court judge in this case twice called the plaintiff, John Steffens, actions. Why did the trial court, Judge D. Dyer of Outagamie County, use such strong language? Judge Dyer concluded that Steffens was intentionally manipulating the judicial system to suit his changing interests over the course of litigation. Steffens filed this personal injury lawsuit alleging that a June 2005 car accident caused him permanent injury. That injury was to his back, and it resulted in a low back surgery. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois paid for that surgery pursuant to the terms of its ERISA-governed health care plan that covered Steffens at the time, to the tune of about $65,000. During litigation, Steffens persuaded the tortfeasor and his auto insurer that back surgery was indeed related to the car accident. This is evident in the $100,000 policy limit settlement Steffens secured from the tortfeasor and his auto insurer. After settling and just weeks before trial, Steffens completely reversed his position. In a blatant attempt to avoid reimbursing Blue Cross for the cost of that surgery, he claimed the surgery was for a pre-existing condition that had nothing to do with the auto accident. He refused to reimburse Blue Cross Blue Shield under the terms of the health care plan. So why was
Counsel,
Steffens...
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
Wasn't there medical information involved here that indicated that this was a congenital condition? So that wasn't something that just came out of left field. Wasn't there some medical basis for it?
There was a defense IME, and that's the position Steffens has asserted, but if you look at the timeline, he continued to assert that the condition was related to the auto accident, even after that defense medical expert report came out, continuing up until the moment of settlement, and at that point, he changed his position. So it was the timeline shows the relationship. Up until six weeks before trial, he was still planning to call his treating doctor, the one who performed the back surgery, and was still and had responded to interrogatories several weeks before trial, still asserting, he had asserted in the witness list that he was, had indicated that he was still asserting relatedness. And the other piece of evidence on that is a disclosure plaintiff's counsel made at the initial hearing on this motion for judicial estoppel, wherein he admitted that during settlement discussions 2 months before trial, he had asserted that he would argue and convince the jury that the back surgery was related.
One of the positions I understand you've taken, and it seems to be probably the chief position, is that this is a situation that involves the doctrine of judicial estoppel. And
yes.
Therefore that he should be stopped, literally, from switching the position based on the independent medical exam. But don't you have a problem with that in that the third factor or third prong for judicial estoppel is missing in this case?
Your Honor, I think that the case law would have to be clarified to demonstrate that it applies in this case. What you're referring to is the element that requires that the position, the first position, be adopted. Other courts...
By a court or a judge, right?
By a court or a judge. And other courts have looked at that a little more broadly and said that we look at whether the party prevails or succeeds on his position. The Seventh Circuit case, Kale, was kind of our exhibit A of where a court has taken the doctrine and applied it to a situation where a party prevails in a settlement sense.
And that's what you're asking us to do, basically, is to expand the doctrine as far as Wisconsin is concerned?
Yes, Your Honor. To clarify, this has never come up in a Wisconsin court. It's never been accepted or rejected in a Wisconsin court. There's also a case that we cite in our brief, an Illinois Court of Appeals case, in state court, where they applied it to a settlement situation. So those courts have had opportunities to specifically address the situation. Now we're asking the Wisconsin court to.
Why do you say that he prevailed? Years and years and years ago, was involved in insurance defense cases and had them come across our desk, and kind of like you are now maybe, have them come across our desk. And if you had medicals of 65,000, I mean, of course, every case is different, but you have some rules of thumb. And rules of thumb would be this, assuming that you had decent liability, that this case is probably going to be worth settling for around three times the medicals. That was our rule of thumb. I'm not saying that was correct. I'm not saying that's the rule of thumb now. I am saying several years ago that was the rule of thumb. That would put you around $200,000, assuming liability was an okay. So here they settle for $100,000, which is kind of 50-50, splitting the difference. Who knows who's going to prevail? Is it a pre-existing condition, congenital, or is there going to be causation? Who knows? If I were the insurance company with a $100,000 policy with medicals at $65,000, well, that's a reasonable approach to take. So I'm not sure they prevail because they got half the value of what they could have gotten, perhaps. You know, I'm giving you hypotheticals, but can you respond to that?
Yes, I can, Justice. In this case, it is quite clear that he prevailed on that position. And I think that the clearest documents that show this are his interrogatory responses before the settlement and his interrogatory responses after the settlement. He responded to an identical set of questions. In the first set of questions, he says his medical specials are $130,000 and that he had permanent injury to his back. Answering the same question after settlement, he said that Blue Cross had paid $1,740 for accident-related injuries. He said that he sustained no permanent injury. He said that he had no lost wages because of the accident, whereas in the prior set of discovery, he said that he had sustained some lost wages after this back surgery. So I think in this case, I can understand that in some cases it would be splitting, hedging our bets, thinking that we have a 50-50 chance of succeeding. That could happen. That's not what happened here. This case, back surgery was either related to the accident, in which case he has a big claim, or he just had that emergency care after the accident, a brief period of headaches, no lost wages, no other medical treatment other than the emergency care treatment. And these are the two positions he's asserting in sworn interrogatory answers. So in this case, there's no way to get to $100,000 based on $1,700 in emergency room bills.
What's the matter with the Court of Appeals decision? I mean, it seems reasonable to me. And this is why I pose that. We're dealing with an ERISA plan, right?
Sorry?
We are dealing with an ERISA plan.
Exactly.
You're representing Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yes.
And they're insuring this plan,
yes.
I assume. Okay. And the plan says if there are any benefits payable under the plan, right, for expenses incurred as a result of or arose out of an accident, which this did, right, such that other parties may be liable, which is true here, right?
Correct.
For the payment of these medical expenses, right? And you subsequently obtain a settlement, right, from or a judgment against such other parties. There was a settlement here, right? you or your dependents are obligated to reimburse the plan, right? You're subrogated, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what the Court of Appeals said under this contract language, it said if you want to be subrogated, if you want to collect $65,000 from the person you're insured, right?
Right,
that you're insuring, they said to be entitled to get that money back, you should prove what expenses were paid as a result of the accident. Because then you'll fit right within the language of your policy. What's the matter with that?
The matter with that, Chief Justice, is that that's not what the case law says. I would point to...
I don't care what... Do we have a case directly on point
in Wisconsin?
We
have, no, we have cutting.
Okay. So we're looking at a contract, right? We're interpreting the contract language and we're applying it to this fact situation, right?
Right.
So tell me why that isn't a reasonable interpretation of this language and why you don't really now stand in the shoes of tortfeasor and prove the same thing. What's the matter with that?
Because, Your Honor,
why are we horsing around with all this judicial estoppel?
Well, Your Honor, we made two claims. We can get our money back under either
Let's
theory.
Let's go on to the contract.
Onto the contract, sure. And the reason we don't stand in the shoes of the insured is because this is not a claim that arises under common law. This is a contract claim. And we have Wisconsin law saying that in rights born of contract, you don't have a plaintiff's burden of proof. And I would point the court to Riegelman and Newport News. In both of those cases, the court rejected the idea that the contract party had to prove to a jury that damages causation in the way that a personal injury plaintiff has to prove damages caused to a jury.
Do you think using the word may has any significance here in the plan language instead of something like are determined, are found, or are adjudicated to be liable?
Sure, and it goes hand in hand with the language that says settlement or a verdict, and it goes hand in hand with the language that talks about that the damages need not be categorized within that settlement in terms of pain and suffering, loss of consortium, or whatnot. Yes, that is very significant.
Counsel, I wonder if you could help me with the procedural posture here a little bit. The accident, the automobile accident happened in 2005. Yes?
Yes.
And then in 2007, that's when the surgery occurred.
Correct.
Now, at some point, your client paid for the surgery.
Correct.
How much did your client pay?
Around $65,000.
And when did it pay that?
I don't know for sure, but I know that there was no dispute that these were promptly paid following
What triggered the payment? In other words, how was it that your client was put on notice, hey, you owe $65,000?
Well, it was an employment-based health care plan, so I assume Stephens had the surgery and then submitted his bills to his health care insurer for reimbursement.
And when that notification was put in, was there a causation included in that notification?
Not that I'm aware of. I assume what happened is that causation got triggered once a lawsuit was filed, and we were brought in as a party to the lawsuit. And then we were served with pleadings claiming permanent injury, discovery.
Okay, so from that point onward, the causation would have been the automobile accident up until the time of settlement, where the $100,000 settlement is reached, and then after that $100,000 settlement is reached, that is when the position switches that it was not related to the automobile accident.
Correct. And, Justice, you bring up an important point, I think, that cuts to one of the policy implications here, which is how promptly are health insurers going to want to reimburse their employees for or pay claims to their employees when they know that their employees can so easily just turn around and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to pay you that money back because I don't have to. Because you, unless you want to file a claim in front of a jury, prove causation to a jury, I have no obligation to pay you back. That's going to cause health insurers to hold back on the payment of benefits.
Well, they're certainly not going. It might provide a little motivation to delay until the causation question can be sorted out.
How would you like a bad faith claim?
Yeah, that's right.
I have a security health insurance. You know, and this is tantamount to a health insurance policy. I mean, right. This is tantamount to it. And so when I go see a health care provider, it goes to security health insurance, and they pay. And that's the way this health care insurance, and I put that in quotes,
right.
You know, that's the way this health care insurance is based. It's not a liability health care insurance. It's a health care insurance.
Correct.
Regardless of causation. Regardless of causation, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Do you really think, then, that security insurance, or pick another name of an insurance company, are going to slow down their reimbursement to health care providers
because of
this case? Or?
Your Honor, In cutting, the point was made by the Seventh Circuit that a plan has no fiduciary interest to its employees to determine the terms of the benefit, but it does have a fiduciary duty to the plan itself. The plan administrators do have a fiduciary duty under ERISA to the plan itself. So the plan has a duty to uphold the terms under ERISA. So I think
which is to pay out the benefits.
Yes, and another provision of that is that the plan has discretion to interpret the terms of its plan, and that determination will be upheld by the courts unless it was unreasonable.
About 3 years ago, this court, which of course did not decide the cutting case, but this court decided a case called Summers versus Touchpoint Health Plan. And that was a ERISA situation also. And in that particular case, the court concluded that the interpretation by the plan administrator was arbitrary and capricious. Is that a legitimate inquiry for the trial court to get into and make in this case?
Yes, I believe that's exactly the standard of review when there's a dispute as to reimbursement. The plan, if it so vests itself with the power to determine, as Cutting says it can under ERISA, then yes, if there is a dispute, then the trial court has judicial review over that dispute under the erroneous exercise of discretion standard.
Is that what should happen in this case?
Yes.
So you wouldn't have any objection to the remand that the Court of Appeals ordered here, but you would like the remand to involve a determination of whether or not the interpretation by the plan administrator was arbitrary and capricious. Is that correct?
Well, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that was the standard. However, it went on to disregard the fact that Steffens himself had asserted that it was related up until 6 weeks before the trial on this issue.
One of the things that concerns me, if this case goes back to the circuit court for a determination of whether or not the interpretation by the plan administrator was arbitrary and capricious, is where is the burden? Is the burden on Steffens, or is the burden on the plan here? On Blue Cross?
The burden, sorry?
On Blue, is the burden on Blue Cross or on Steffens?
The burden to prove causation?
Well, the burden to determine whether or not the interpretation is arbitrary and capricious.
Well, that's the standard of review. I mean, the decision has been made by the plan administrator, and then it's...
Well, I certainly understand that there's a connection, a causal connection here, as well as the arbitrary and capricious standard. But my question goes to who has the burden. if there's a question as to whether or not the interpretation is arbitrary and capricious by the plan administrator, who has the burden of establishing that? Is that Stephan's burden or is that Blue Cross's burden to counter it? In other words, to say it wasn't arbitrary and capricious.
Right, Your Honor, and I believe that that would be Stephan's burden to show that it was not, to show that it was arbitrary and capricious. And I think the cases in Wisconsin that we have are Riegelman and Newport, and both of those looked at this kind of a situation as a medical lien. And in determining the amount of the lien, the plaintiff has to put into question those expenses that have been determined related.
Counsel, it's my understanding that Stephan's added Blue Cross, Blue Shield in because of their possible subrogation interest, right? They were sued by the plaintiff.
Correct.
Okay. When settlement discussions started, or when they were had, was Blue Cross, Blue Shield invited to those discussions?
No, Justice, we did not know that they were happening.
When settlement was obtained, did Blue Cross and Blue Shield receive notice of that settlement?
Yes, we realized the settlement had occurred. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but we got notification from the settling defendant that settlement had occurred.
And the dollar amount was told to you?
Yes.
Okay. So there was no request to keep the dollar amount from you?
No. We're not sure if we were in, we were provided, I think it was called a courtesy copy of the settlement by the defendant in an email attachment.
Would you typically be informed that there might be settlement negotiations?
Yes, Justice, as a subrogated party, we're entitled to participate in a case to the full extent of any of the other parties.
Do you think in your plan, it talks about the subrogation rights and legal claims and whatnot. It says this means the plan has the right to act in place of you or your dependents to make a lawful claim or demand against any such other party. The plan has first priority with respect to its right to reduction, reimbursement, and subrogation. Where it says this means the plan has the right to act in place of you or your dependents to make a lawful claim or demand. Is it your position at all that Blue Cross should have been invited to the table when they were talking settlement discussions?
Yes, that is our position. Absolutely.
What was the plan administrator's interpretation of the contract language I read to you?
That if an insured incurs an expense that we pay for, such that another person may be liable and you subsequently obtain settlement from it, then we're entitled to reimbursement.
Well, but may be liable, what does that mean? Well, how did he interpret it?
Well, it's a
highly likely, highly probable, maybe, it's an arguably liable. I mean, here there was a fight, right?
Yes.
The other insurance company said, hey, it's not caused by the accident. The plaintiff says it was caused by the accident. No one decided whether it was or wasn't caused by the accident.
Yeah,
so we don't know if this was the payment of expenses for which another party is liable. Right?
It was more than a fight. It was a lawsuit. The chances of liability were real.
And the settlement didn't say we're paying you for medical damages caused by, for injuries caused by the accident. I mean, there was nothing in the settlement that says this was as a result of the accident, the back injury.
Your Honor, I believe it does, I think the settlement does, and I would have to refer to the language that's in our appendix, does tie the settlement amount to the accident that the lawsuit is based
on. Sure,
they
didn't get paid, they were paid because of the accident, that's clear.
Right.
But it doesn't clearly say that the back injury was caused by the accident, does it?
Well, without the back injury, we've got a $2,000 emergency room visit, and that's it.
That may be.
And I would also like to point out
that may be. Mm-hmm. But it could have been that there was a back injury that was aggravated by the accident. Then you'd be liable for that.
Well, the plaintiff's counsel admitted at oral argument that they did make that they did secure the $100,000 settlement by saying that they would, that if on the off chance the jury is persuaded that there was causation. So this is more than just theoretical. This is really the course that this lawsuit was taking. They had named their surgeon as a trial witness twice, and then argued to the tortfeasor that they would prove that the surgery was related in order to get a big verdict.
Ms. German-Prey, the reason I asked you what did your counsel, what did the administrator say in interpreting it is because I thought that Justice Crooks had a very good point. This was returned to the trial court by the Court of Appeals, not to do what Justice Crook said, but to get the evidence and that the circuit court, I'm sorry, that the Court of Appeals wanted. But Justice Crook says maybe that's not the right way of approaching this case. And we ought to go back and see whether the administrator is reasonable, because if he's unreasonable, we knock it out. I mean, you agree that's the law. So that's why I wanted to have as precise a response as to what the administrator decided. The administrator decided in all cases, I, the administrator, decide what may be liable. I, as the administrator, look at the documents. I, the administrator, require proof. I mean, then we know what we're sending it back for. Okay?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. This is my day for surnames. Amy Marie, is it Rizu? Rizu. Thank you, Ms. Rizu. Representing John R. Steffens.
Sorry, I'm not as tall. May it please the court, my name is Amy Rizu, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, John Steffens. Today we'll be addressing two issues. The first is that judicial estoppel does not apply in this case and should not apply in this case. The second issue is that Blue Cross Blue Shield has to prove which bills it paid were causally related to the accident in order to be reimbursed or subrogated. I'll familiarize the court again with the facts, even though we've heard some from opposing counsel. John Steffens was injured in an automobile accident on June 29, 2005. He initially complained of neck pain and headaches. Steffens first complained of low back pain on March 6, 2006, 8 months after his accident. In May of 2007, almost 2 years after his accident, Mr. Steffens underwent a low back surgery, an L5-S1 fusion. The only medical evidence in this case to date regarding the cause of Mr. Steffens' surgery is a report written by Dr. Menacci, an independent medical examiner. Dr. Menacci stated that the surgery was caused by a degenerative condition, not trauma. Based upon this evidence, and the absence of any evidence to the contrary, Steffens maintained that Blue Cross Blue Shield was not entitled to any reimbursement for the surgical costs. The court dismissed this case based on judicial estoppel. Judicial estoppel does not apply in this case and should not apply in this case. The purpose of judicial estoppel, as stated in State v. Petty and State v. Fleming, is to protect the judiciary. It is not intended to protect the relationship between the parties. There are three elements for judicial estoppel to apply. First, that there are two inconsistent statements. Second, that there are the same facts in both cases. And third, that the party to be estopped has convinced the court to take its position. I'll deal with those in reverse order. For judicial estoppel to apply, the party to be estopped must first convince the court to adopt its position. In this case, Steffens never convinced the court to adopt his position. He never advanced his position before the court. It was stated in discovery and pleadings.
Counselor, did the court adopt the stipulation?
What stipulation are you referring to? The stipulation order for dismissal of the defense insurance company?
Yes.
The court did sign the order to dismiss AIG.
In so doing, did it approve the stipulation?
The court approved the dismissal of AIG, but that did not affect the Blue Cross Blue Shield was not a party to that dismissal. Their rights were not violated.
I understand that. What I'm asking you is, did the court approve the stipulation?
Yes, Madam Justice.
Okay, that was what I need to know. Thank you.
It's interesting that you bring that up, as it relates to the case of Ferrick versus Matrix Moving Systems. In that case, there was an arbitration award, and the party supposed to pay the award, the attorneys representing that party twice stated that the money was in their trust account. Then later before the court, those same attorneys said, actually, we don't have the money. The party seeking to have the funds claimed estoppel. In that case, the trial court signed an order. Upon review, the Court of Appeals held that signing that order was not agreeing with the position of the party who had stated the money was there and then not. And the Court of Appeals explained that the party must specifically request that the court adopt that particular position and agree with it. Also, to go back to the Olson case, in Olson, the plaintiff stated in its summons and complaint that the damages in the case were less than $75,000 to keep the case for federal removal. When it came time for a Perringer release and settlement and eventual trial, the defendants wished to hold the plaintiff to $75,000 or less. The Court of Appeals held that pleading an amount in controversy is not the same as convincing the court to adopt a position. No Wisconsin case has addressed estoppel in the context of a settlement. Given the stated position and purpose of protecting the judiciary, it doesn't make sense to extend the doctrine to cover settlements. Outside authorities have determined that estoppel doesn't apply to settlements, such as the Sixth Circuit. In City of Kingsport versus Steel and Roof Structure, for example, the Sixth Circuit flat out stated that a judicial estoppel does not apply to settlements.
Counselor, are the cases you're referring to cases where the settlement was not put before the court as part of a stipulation to dismiss a party, or how did they fit in?
The procedural history is not always stated in the opinions, but there is no, every case is dismissed. Every settlement that I've ever reached in a case, there's still a stip in order to dismiss the case to get it off the court's docket. You make the court aware of the settlement. Parties sign an agreement saying we've settled this case, we'll no longer be going to the court. But those documents often, first of all, don't contain amounts, which is for the protection of our clients, that there's not public records stating the amount of their settlements. Also for the protection of defendants, that it's not obvious what they've paid in settlement on different claims. So there's a stip in order in every case to dismiss the case, simply to clear away the court's docket and for administrative purposes. But in that process, the circuit court judge is not doing any sort of analysis to determine whether the settlement was reasonable or to provide details of the settlement parameters.
So, counsel, if this were a minor settlement instead of a settlement of an adult's claim, would there be a different outcome here for Blue Cross Blue Shield? Because then the court is required. You know, having done a number of minor settlements, then you take testimony, you have a guardian ad litem, mm-hmm. you make a finding, you adopt it, you find that it's reasonably related, that the, you know, I mean, you make a whole host of findings. So are you saying that there's a different standard that would be applied in a minor settlement? And that's it? That's it? That's what you have to have in order for a court to have approved it?
No, Justice. Actually, in a minor settlement, I would imagine the arguments would be exactly the same as we're having right now. Because there would be a guardian ad litem who would protect the interests of the minor. And if that guardian ad litem believed that someone was seeking to recover from funds from the minor without any medical proof for that assertion, that guardian ad litem would be arguing to the court not to reimburse Blue Cross Blue Shield.
No, I mean, the court would have to approve the settlement that the plaintiff received from AIG. If the plaintiff is a minor instead of being an adult, the plaintiff is an adult here, then the court would have to approve that settlement as reasonable, reasonably related, et cetera, have a whole list of what the expenses were that were incurred and all that. If the court approves the settlement, well, what role would Blue Cross Blue Shield play in a minor settlement versus in the one here? And if the court approves the settlement, tell me how it'd be different.
Sure. This goes directly to the third point, that they convince the trial court to take a position. If there's a minor settlement, in my experience, there's a hearing. And during that hearing, testimony is taken. It may be evidence from a doctor. It may be testimony from the minor themselves. At that point, there is an urging of the court to adopt a position. Should Mr. Steffens have been a child and gone to the court and said, my back surgery was caused by this accident, and urged the court to adopt that position, then he would be a stop from changing it later on. That's completely different than what happened in this case. He never brought his position before the court. Also, should we be talking about the same scenario where Steffens is a minor, whether a surgery is causally related to an accident is often the subject of expert testimony. The court may not allow simply Steffens stating, my surgery is related to this car accident, to be sufficient. He is a layperson. He does not have the foundation or the expertise to know whether or not his pain and suffering is generated by something that was caused in the accident or a degenerative condition. In that circumstance, in a minor settlement hearing, the court may require deposition testimony or expert witness medical testimony from the treating surgeon. That was really one of the issues that put us in the situation we're in today, is the defense insurance company, AIG, never deposed the treating doctors.
Would at the minor settlement hearing, Blue Cross Blue Shield be given notice of the hearing, have the opportunity to appear, ask questions, and put forth their position?
Of course. Of course. And to refer to something previously said by opposing counsel, there was no settlement conference. This case settled by a phone call. What happened is once the excess, an attorney was hired to represent the individual insured's interests. Shortly after that attorney appeared in the case, a phone call came into the office saying, we'll pay the $100,000 policy limit if you release our insured. It would be completely unusual at that moment to say, wait, I need to get the subrogated health insurer on the phone as you offer me this money as well. This wasn't an issue of trying to keep anyone in the dark. It was simply a phone call that came in for the policy limits.
Why wasn't there a RIMES hearing here?
RIMES is to determine whether a plaintiff has been made whole, mm-hmm. and made whole does not apply to ERISA policies.
Oh,
so this ERISA plan, I should say ERISA allows the plans to write out made whole, and this plan did. So we have no ability to determine whether Mr. Steffens was made whole. Because obviously, to bring a point you brought up earlier, Justice, his bills for the surgery, if you include that, were $133,000. $100,000 doesn't even cover all of his bills. I wonder at what point we all know when a settlement is enough to know that that surgery was included. Would it be at $20,000, $30,000, $40,000? I don't have any sort of magical formula. I'm familiar with the specials times three rule you stated, but we all know that's not a set-in-stone formula and every case is different. But there is no magical formula to determine in a settlement what bills were covered and what weren't. It just simply does not exist. It would make all of our jobs a lot easier if it did.
Counsel, I'd like to get on to the ERISA issue, okay? My understanding is that what the Court of Appeals did here was reverse the circuit court and remand this case to the circuit court. And my understanding is that the remand basically was couched in terms of causal connection between the bills paid by Blue Cross Blue Shield and whether or not there's a causal connection to the accident. I'm not convinced that that is necessarily the right approach. My concern, I guess, goes back to the Summers case that I questioned opposing counsel about earlier. In the Summers case, as you've got the same issue here, you've got this ERISA plan, you've got an interpretation by the administrator of the plan, and the issue seems to become whether or not that interpretation by the plan administrator is a correct one or whether or not it's arbitrary and capricious. Assuming that, should there be that overlay to the remand by the Court of Appeals here? In other words, should there be issues to be addressed not only in terms of causal connection to the accident, but also in terms of whether or not the plan administrator's interpretation is arbitrary and capricious here?
It's our position that the two kind of take care of themselves. In the Cutting decision, Cutting versus Jerome Foods, the court held that there must be some interpretive principles adopted by the courts to deal with the ERISA plans. In that case, they decided that the made whole rule was not a universal rule of construction or interpretation, and therefore made whole would not be required in ERISA plan cases. However, cause is a universal rule. Duty, breach, cause, damages is required for every tort across this state and across this nation. Cause is a fundamental element of a tort, and as such, the courts have the ability to apply interpretive principles for that universal rule. I posit that the court should require a jury trial to determine cause. Multiple Wisconsin cases, for example, Nichols versus Progressive Northern Insurance Company, state that causation is an issue for jury determination. Also, it's a basic tenet of American jurisprudence that whatever party wants a special verdict to be answered yes must have the burden of proof in that case.
Well, you're still not getting to what I want you to get to, I guess. I'd like you to tell me, and I thought initially you started out answering this way, that there's some overlap between causal connection and arbitrary and capricious interpretation by a plan administrator. Am I correct that's where you were going?
It is arbitrary and capricious for the plan administrator to determine that it is the sole decider on cause. And the court on remand, obviously this didn't happen at all at the circuit court trial level. This question was never reached. On remand, the court could determine that it's arbitrary and capricious and should determine that the plan administrator is the sole decision maker on cause. There should be a greater decision maker, the jury system, at least some sort of hearing where evidence is introduced. If the court, what Stephens suspected would happen at this pretrial where the judicial estoppel and everything came up, is that we would set possibly an adjournment as Blue Cross Blue Shield had requested, but that we would be going to trial in a few weeks or a few months, and Stephens would have testimony from his treating physician and perhaps Dr. Menachi. versus whatever testimony Blue Cross Blue Shield could come up with to state that these bills were related.
Counselor, the cause you're talking about is a tort concept, but the claim that's being made here is a contract claim. It's not the same thing at all, in my view. And I think that's what Justice Prosser is trying to get you to look at. Justice Roberts, I should say. Keep from mixing you up. In other words, he's not looking at cause the way you are for the plaintiff in a PI case. And he's looking at the standard that is a contract standard that has to be applied to an ERISA policy when you're interpreting the policy. And I think what he wants you to focus on is how that fits in with the contract claim that's being made here. It's not a tort claim. It's a contract claim.
Thank you for clarifying. It's not possible to review this contract claim without having some terms carry over from tort law. The language that I believe Chief Justice Abrahamson read earlier was that the payments must be for expenses incurred as a result of or that arose out of an accident. That is the contract language. And that language requires some kind of nexus between the accident and the bills. Otherwise, there's no reason, if this plan language isn't followed and the plan has sole discretion to interpret that, they can then take bunion surgery and get reimbursed for that when there's an accident, or pneumonia, or any unrelated medical charge, to the point that health insurance is simply illusory.
Counsel, in looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, I'm focusing on the second to the last and the last paragraphs of that opinion. And right before the last paragraph, and this dovetails into what's being discussed now, and looking at the contract, the Court of Appeals in the last sentence of its second to last paragraph says, the plain terms of Blue Cross's plan permit reimbursement only for bills incurred as a result of an accident for which another actually is liable. Therefore, Blue Cross's interpretation of the plan as requiring reimbursement regardless of whether Stefan's surgery was caused by the accident is unreasonable. So as I interpret the Court of Appeals opinion, they're looking at a contract, and not always, but normally it's a question of law. You know, what does the language mean? Sometimes the facts are involved. And they're saying that as a matter of law, the interpretation was unreasonable because Blue Cross's interpretation of the plan as requiring reimbursement regardless of whether Stephen's surgery was caused by the accident is unreasonable. Then I get to the last sentence of the last paragraph and what their remand is. So they then remand to give Blue Cross an opportunity to prove its entitlement to reimbursement for Stefan's surgery. I interpret that remand to be a fact determination as to causation. Is that how you interpret that, or do you interpret it differently? I don't know.
No, I interpret that exactly, Justice. There's the practical issue of what exactly does a court do with that? Does the court have a trial by the court? Do they have a motion hearing? You know, how exactly is that done? And there's really no procedural guidance on that besides relying on basic jurisprudence and law.
I think that there is procedural guidance on whether an ERISA plan has been interpreted in an arbitrary and capricious manner. And I do think there's flexibility, if you read the law, about the interpretation of such a plan. And if it goes back down, it's possible that there will be some examination of whether or not the plan administrator properly determined that this payment was related to the accident. But it's a very different standard than determining cause as we would in a tort claim. You interpret whether his interpretation of whether the plan was interpreted in a manner that's arbitrary and capricious. And Justice Crooks, alias Roberts and Prosser, has focused you a little bit on touch point. And the reason he's done that is he wrote it. and it sets a standard out that you need to apply. So,
well, my question is, looking at the Court of Appeals, Blue Cross's interpretation as requiring reimbursement, regardless of whether the surgery was caused by the accident, is unreasonable. What was Blue Cross's interpretation? I mean, the Court of Appeals says, the Court of Appeals says that the plan administrator, if I'm just reading this sentence, says, Mr. Steffens, you've got to pay us $65,000. We don't care whether Steffens' surgery was caused by the accident. Is that what his interpretation was?
That's all that was communicated to our office.
Where is that in the record?
I believe there were letters appended to the summary judgment motion, but I'm not sure that those were part of the record, as they were communications between counsel for Blue Cross and our office.
Well, how did the Court of Appeals learn of this? I mean, did you have oral argument before the Court of Appeals? No.
No, there was not oral argument before the Court of Appeals.
Okay, so that they had to have something in writing in the record that told them that the plan administrator said, pay us regardless of whether the surgery was caused by the accident. So I've got this part of the record. I don't know if there's more. Is there more to the record than this?
The record in this case is actually quite small, which is part of the reason we're here, is there was never any evidence besides the Menache report on whether or not the surgery was caused by the accident.
Well, I haven't read the whole record, and it is quite small. But I don't see a dismissal here of the of this action?
I'm sorry?
I don't see the dismissal of that action, the prior action.
I believe AIG was dismissed at the motion hearing, as was Farmers, but I could be mistaken.
I'm just looking at the docket sheet, you know, the summary, okay. I should say, of what's here. So I don't see that, and I don't see a stipulation. Could be here, but I just don't see it. And so you say that there's a letter here or letters between counsel that explain what the plan administrator's interpretation was.
I don't know that it explains the plan administrator interpretation, but it was the representations of counsel of why they were not obligated to prove causation.
Counsel,
the plan administrator's agent.
Correct.
Is in here, and the explanation is reimbursement regardless of whether the surgery was caused.
Well, I like that language. The real...
Oh, you would.
It is good language.
Yep.
It was more based on the estoppel argument.
Pardon me?
Based on the judicial estoppel argument, that at this point he couldn't change his position because he had previously stated in interrogatories and in scheduling conference statements that this surgery was causally related.
Counsel, can you help me out? When Justice Bradley read the language from paragraph 15 of the Court of Appeals decision, she read, the plain terms of the plan permit reimbursement only for bills incurred as a result of an accident for which another actually is liable. Where does the plan, this is what I started out in the beginning talking about, where does the plan say that the other actually is liable?
It doesn't. Again, this is a point where I like the Court of Appeals language, but it's not accurate. Okay. The plan says that another may be liable. However, it doesn't say were for expenses which may have been incurred as a result of an accident. There is no equivocation on the plan language where their reimbursement is required for expenses incurred as a result of or that arose out of an accident. This is what goes to the Newport News decision, for example, where an ERISA carrier is not required to prove negligence. That's very different than cause.
I just wondered if you thought the court was right when that language was being cited to you.
Again, I like the language, but it's not what's in the plan. The plan is that another may be liable.
Not actually. Actually is wrong in that sentence.
Correct. Correct.
And is wrong. It says may.
I'm sorry?
Is not necessarily correct there. It should be may.
Correct. It's where another may be liable. And again, that gets back to that a subrogated ERISA plan does not have an obligation to prove negligence. So Stephens could not say, I'm not going to pay you back until you prove I would have won this case at trial. And that's well and settled in the law. But that doesn't address the issue of causation.
And when you say causation, what you're talking about is whether you can tie the injuries to the accident, right? And that's why you're focusing so much on the fact that he has an IME that says they're degenerative rather than trauma cause, correct?
Correct. Causation is a vibrant issue in the vast majority of personal injury cases. The dispute on what injuries are related to an accident versus related to our bodies and their natural degenerative processes or other incidents, falls, accidents that may have happened. This is a topic that is hotly contested in most personal injury cases. I always say if it's easy, they don't need us. So if it was clear where the injury comes one to the other, oftentimes counsel are never involved because the case settles before it ever gets to attorneys. But when there's a dispute and a complicated medical history to look at, then it's often debated. Which brings me back to my point, at what point do we know when Stephens recovered for this surgery? What number puts us in that position? This case is complicated further by the policy limit.
And an offer for judgment.
Yes, an offer for judgment as well. And when there's a policy limit, there's always the potential to pursue the individual insured for any excess, but the likelihood of recovering any assets from an individual is very small. And it's often something that a plaintiff's counsel will not recommend, and a plaintiff themselves do not wish to bankrupt another individual solely for an accident. So oftentimes, the policy limit is it. That is all the funds are discussed in the case.
The release here indicates the release of the tortfeasor. So although there aren't a lot of facts on the accident here, and although I can't find a stipulation in order for dismissal, am I to understand that the stipulation in order for dismissal releases all in the lawsuit? That is, the lawsuit, the case is dismissed?
I apologize for not knowing this. I don't know that the stipend order was signed in this case. If there was one, and I see my time is up, may I continue?
You may respond.
There, at the motion hearing, there was an attempt to dismiss AIG and their counsel and Farmers or Pekin, it's been called both, who had a small med pay claim as well, about $2,000. Those were to be dismissed. I don't know that the court actually did a stip in order, if they just said that you guys won't participate in the appeal and left the other parties to continue on. But there was never any dismissal. It was always clear that the case maintained between Blue Cross Blue Shield and the plaintiff.
Counselor, in regard to the payment way back after the surgery occurred, was there any representation made by Mr. Stephens to Blue Cross and Blue Shield at that time to achieve payment as to what the surgery was necessitated by? Or did he just submit the bills from his doctor? Do you have any idea?
The bills were just simply submitted. And that's what I would recommend all of my plaintiffs do. If the plaintiff would say, this shouldn't be my health insurance problem, this should be the other guy's insurance paying these bills, they don't pay them until the end. Mm-hmm. So then interest charges accrue, collection actions happen. A plaintiff should always run his bills or her bills through the health insurance company, who then is reimbursed, which we are happy to reimburse Blue Cross Blue Shield upon proof of causation. Without that, it's irresponsible for me to turn around and pay someone my client's funds without them putting forth any evidence that they're entitled to those funds.
Yeah, well, my question just was, there anything in the record that you know about that shows
no.
Or made any representation that they passed?
And there would not be.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. German-Prey?
Thank you. I'd like to respond to a few points. Counsel's claim that there is the only evidence in the record that the back surgery was related to the car accident is Dr. Menachie, the independent medical examiner's report. If that's the case, then why did the plaintiffs name their treating surgeon as their witness 2 months before trial? And if that's true, why did they answer sworn discovery stating that he incurred a back surgery on May 22, 2007 because of the accident? He could have objected to that discovery answer. I'd also like to respond to the claim that Steffens never brought his position before the court. I, again, take issue with that. Steffens brought his position that the back surgery was related to the court by stating as much in a scheduling conference statement to the court and by submitting a witness list, again, naming his treating physician as a witness.
Did you depose the treating physician so you know what he will say or would have said?
No, we did not. There was talk about it, and then we moved for declaratory judgment, and everything got put on hold during that time.
Was a report submitted?
Not by the treating physician, no.
Was there a date to submit permanency or name your permanency expert?
I don't know if the word permanency was included in there, but I know it was a date to name your experts. And for whatever reason, there were actually two witness lists filed in this case, one early in the litigation and then one in December by the plaintiff I'm referring to, and both of them include the treating physician's name.
Theoretically, I don't know if this is practically, but theoretically, you could name the treating physician for the reasonableness of the amount recovered. If the treating physician wasn't willing to give an opinion on causation, you still have to prove the damages if there isn't going to be a stipulation to the reasonableness and necessity of the medical bills.
Right, but in this case, if he wasn't claiming the back injury, he's limited to the emergency room care after the accident. There would be no reason for this back surgeon who treated him 2 years later to talk about that. And then finally, on the issue of proving causation, as it's been referred to, I realize that the court has honed in on this issue of, this is a contract claim, this is not a tort claim, which is obviously what we've been asserting. And so then the question becomes, well, then what is the standard of proof? What is the burden here? What we know from Wisconsin cases is that the burden is not that Blue Cross has to prove to a jury, because in both of those cases, that's what one party had argued, and that's what the court rejected. And based on Cutting, the Seventh Circuit case, we know that a plan has discretion to make these decisions so long as the decision is not arbitrary and capricious. So there we have another standard phrase in a slightly different way.
Counsel, that brings me to paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals opinion, which is the very point you're making. In the first sentence of paragraph 14, it says, Blue Cross also argues it's relieved from proving Steffens' surgery was related to his accident because it has the sole discretion to interpret the plan. Is that your argument? Your
argument at all? We realize the plan itself says, as Chief Justice pointed out at the beginning of this argument, that yes, there has to be, as a result of, I think is the term used. So that's not our position at all. Our question is, what is the correct standard? And the standard is reasonableness by the plan administrator.
Counselor, was the dismissal of AIG and the settlement, were there any settlement documents attached to the stipulation and order for dismissal of AIG?
The only settlement documents that we have are provided in this appendix.
Mm-hmm. Is that the release you're referring to?
It is.
Yeah. What page?
That's the one you have.
This is petitioner's appendix at 161.
Okay. Thank you.
Was there a stipulation and order, a written stipulation and order for dismissal to your knowledge in this case?
Knowledge.
It doesn't appear to be in the record we have.
The final release at 161 was not filed with the court, right?
To my knowledge.
Right. That, in an adult case, that wouldn't typically be on file with the court. The parties settle. They notify the court. It needs to be dismissed. It gets dismissed. But in a minor settlement, it would be different, right?
Yeah, this is what we've received as a courtesy copy from defense counsel.
And what was appealed from is this the other order relating to this case, not the case of Steffens versus AIG.
Correct.
In paragraph 14 that Justice Bradley read to you, there the Court of Appeals says that the interpretation is that the plan requires Steffens to reimburse it for bills he used to leverage his settlement, whether they were related to the accident or not. In 17, the Court of Appeals uses a different interpretation, that is, recites the plan's interpretation differently. Which is it? In 14, it's, if he uses it to leverage it, he has to pay back the plan. In 15, the interpretation is, regardless of the surgery was caused by the accident, he has to reimburse. I mean, there's a difference in what the plan interpretation is as set forth by the Court of Appeals. See what I mean? In 14,
Your Honor,
it requires leverage. 15, it doesn't require leverage.
Right, leverage is not part of the plan, and leverage is not an element.
And is there any place in the record where it's clearly stated what the plan interpretation is?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Justices.
I want to thank both counsel, Ms. Germanprey and Ms. Risu, for their arguments today on yet another case that involves subrogation, but this time in an ERISA format. We don't get too many ERISA cases of federal statute. And we appreciate your briefs and your argument. And that ends the hearing in 09 AP 1558, John R. Steffens versus Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. The students may remain here if they can stay for a discussion with Justice Gableman, and they may be joined by other students. The court is in recess until 1:30.